In this episode, Justine recommends a novel where a band of sleuths called the Spinster Sisters search for a killer. And my guest, Meredith Dench, is here to not only talk about serial killers, but explain why she hangs out at a prison, too. I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Justine, Meredith Dench is my guest today, and it's interesting because this will be the second week in a row that we are focusing on serial killers.
Oh, yeah, because that's such a rare thing on your show.
We haven't had any in a while.
Oh, that's interesting. I guess not then.
And I can assure you, no one has been as obsessed of serial killers as Meredith. It's a good discussion about that.
Excellent. Sounds really good. I'm looking forward to hearing it.
And before you do your book recommendation segment, I want to do a shout out. This is to Steve4803. That's the best name that I have. Steve4803. I don't know what the 4803 means.
It means there were 4,802 thieves before him.
You're probably right. Anyway, Steve said, great show. Justine's reviews helped me choose my next book, and Brad knows how to have an interesting conversation with guests. I highly recommend.
Excellent. Wonderful. Wonderful.
And anybody else that would like to leave a review, we won't complain a bit. They are wonderful, and they help draw attention.
That's right. And if you want to say something, you know, critical, we'll take it into account. It may be something that we disagreed with each other on and we've gone one way, and your criticism makes the other person say, aha, I was right all along, told you so. So don't feel like we're not open to even non-constructive criticism.
Actually, let me say this. If somebody would like us to do something different on the show, send us an email, which we have gotten. That's pretty cool. But if you have some issues with what we do, go ahead and put those on the review. I see them as two different things.
Okay. That sounds fine.
I think that's fair.
You know, I'm sure people are going to sit there and analyze their comment to decide, oh, should I put this in a review? I mean, guys, whatever you want to do, just you know, communicate.
Absolutely. I had like quite a few emails last week about how much fun Anne McMahon was and how fun Chris was last week. So those are wonderful, but tell others in a nice review.
Sounds great. Sounds wonderful.
All right. And that's all I really have to begin. It's your show now.
Oh, it's my show now. Well, you know, I've probably got, you know, a summer full of recommendations for people. But let me give you my main recommendation. This is a very new author, and I have absolutely no information on this author. I suspect it's even a pen name. The publication date was July 6th. The author's name is B.K. Asbury. I don't even know if they're male or female or where they live or if, you know, they're a team of high school students putting out something over the summer. Couldn't even tell you.
It could be Monkeys with Computers.
Well, I don't think Monkeys with Computers would be this clever.
Eventually they get lucky.
That's right. No, this was not a get lucky. This was not a get lucky.
The name of this book?
It's called... Oh, there we go. I will tell you the name anytime you want to let me.
Okay, I will be quiet now. What is the name of this book?
It's called Murder at Armory. And you know, with my accent, I don't always say words correctly. Armory, like a place where people used to keep weapons and everything. Most towns' armories are turned over into event space. So it's Murder at Armory. It's a Ty and Matt mystery. It is book one of the Ty and Matt mystery series. And if you ever want to make sure that the series does not stop at book one, go and buy it, or it's on Kindle Unlimited, borrow it and read it. Make sure this author, you know, has a burst of a response and do it that way. It does say it's a young adult book, which I'm not sure if that's really correct. I mean, it says reading age is 12 to 18. I think it's really more of a cozy mystery. So whoever rated a young adult book is probably looking at the lack of sex. But cozy mysteries also have the same lack of sex in them. I recommend it for the vast majority of our listeners who are indeed adults. Ty and Matt have known each other since they were 13 in Brooklyn. They're now in love and living together. They decided that they wanted to live in a small town. So Ty is a florist and Matt is a pizza maker. So they went and spent a lot of weekends going down the shore and finding a town that didn't have a florist and didn't have a pizza place. And 5 years ago, they picked out Ocean View. They now have a florist shop, which they rent, and they live in the apartment above, and they also rent the pizza shop. And they rent these spaces from these spinster sisters. And I will tell you, I aspire to be one of the spinster sisters when I grow up. Let me start with the mystery, and then I'll circle back around to this.
Okay.
Ty is doing an event. He's doing the flowers for an event. It's a product launch at the Armory. And he goes there, and the business person who realizes just out of money and wants to avoid paying for things is complaining about the flowers, which are very high quality, but she's complaining about how she, you know, they're dying, etc., etc. And they get into this loud argument. Ty storms off. She ends up murdered in the parking lot. And he is the number one suspect. The chief of police in this small town knows damn well that Ty didn't do it. But then there are people above him in the area who, you know, aren't familiar with the ins and outs of the people in the town, who are really putting a lot of pressure on the police chief to arrest Ty and get it all taken care of. And so there's a lot of pressure to find the real killer by both all the police chief, Ty and Matt, and their landladies, the spinster sisters. These spinster sisters are rather eccentric. They drive a red Cadillac convertible with white interior, playing Norwegian heavy metal music. They enjoy mysteries. They have a ham radio. They heard the police band over it about the murder. They went to check it out and see. And they just happened to accidentally forget that there was a notebook there that they picked up and put into their purse. And, you know, they just forgot to return it. And now, well, they can't give it back now because they may be charged with obstruction of justice. So obviously the only thing to do is for these four to get together and solve this mystery. And that is where the series takes off. The spinster sisters live in this house in which the parlor is modeled after Sherlock Holmes's parlor. It's not just modeled after it. It's a copy, a replica of the Sherlock Holmes parlor. They have an office upstairs that is a replica of Nero Wolfe's brownstone. And they are actually very, very good at solving mysteries and coming up with plans and talking other people into very risque plans. As elderly women, well known in town, who's going to suspect them? I'm not sure that by the time we get to the fifth book of the series, it's not going to be one of these, you know, Jessica Fletcher's always at the murder scene, and the spinster sisters always happen to show up at the murder scene. But in this first round, they are able to slide in and out of situations with ease because of who they are and how they act. I give this book a delightful recommendation.
A delightful recommendation.
Oh, it's just charming all the way out. They end up with a bunch of fiascos and sneaking into places and taking our personas, and it's just a lot.
You know, you said you would like to be one of these old spinsters.
Yes.
I can really picture you as a kick-ass old spinster.
Yes, yes, yes. That's what I aim to be. I always said when I get older, I want to be eccentric. That's my goal in life.
Well, you've already matched that one.
All right. So anyway, I've got a few honorable mentions this week. Let me just kind of take things that don't necessarily fit into a full recommendation. Now, the next book that I am going to recommend is, you know, we did some of the same authors early on. I repeated Frank Butterfield. I recommend a couple of his books, and Marshall Thornton, I recommend a couple of his books. But as we went along, I decided that, you know, once people have discovered an author or a series, that I really wanted to introduce them to something that maybe they weren't familiar with. They either would, you know, pick that up and like it and then buy something else or not. So I don't usually recommend the same authors over and over. So this is not a full-blown recommendation. But the third book has come out in the Jake Weston Mysteries by Marco Realmonte. The first book was Murder at White Oak. It won LGBTQ Book of the Year. No, it didn't win. It was a finalist, independent author. I recommended that in a full-blown recommendation. I loved it. I thought it was terrific. I put it down and I immediately picked up the second one, The Butcher of Oxford. And then now he has a third one out. If you're not familiar with the series, it's a young adult book. Jake does not struggle with coming out. He is out and proud. And there's a fair amount of time travel, alternate realities and the like, which we all know I love. The third book is called The Michaelmas Killer, which Michaelmas is a holiday in England, and I will garble it and offend everybody if I try to explain it. So you either know about it or you can look it up. It starts with some paranormal stuff. They kind of dispatch the monster somewhere along the way early in the book, and then it turns into a straight mystery. And then at the end, the epilogue has got some paranormal back into it, time travel, and book four in the series really will tickle my fancy. It promises to be a time travel book where both these guys, they're finally a couple and they're going to travel through time together. And I'm looking forward to that. But the third book is out. It's terrific. It's The Michaelmas Killer. And I gave you an interesting little tidbit about this book. Brad, why don't you let our listeners know what it is so they can hear another voice right now?
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, now I've drawn a blank.
Oh, come on. What's the character?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yes. There is a character in this book. And he's a delightful character for no other reason because his name. The character's name happens to be Dr. Brad Adamek.
There we go. See? People will now start rumors that we're married.
Well, yeah, exactly. It caught both of us off guard. Marco thought it was really funny. You know, how do you put two characters in one novel that he knows? Well, he just combined us together. So I don't know if he acts like either of us. You would know better than I did, but don't give it away.
Well, I took a screenshot of that page, and I sent it to you, and you're like, oh, Dr. Adamek, is that just a coincidence? Or I'm like, it's not just a coincidence. Why don't you take a look at that first name there, Mr. Brad? And he's like, oh, I got it. All right, so I'm going to give you, I know we're running long, but I want to give people one more honorable mention. I'll make this one quick.
Okay.
There is a true crime book. And, you know, I was going to pick it up and do it, but, you know, a lot of true crime books read like novels and they just have the real details and excerpts from interviews and the like. But this is a history of true crime. It's called Indecent Advances, A Hidden History of True Crime and Prejudice Before Stonewall. It goes from the 1920s to Stonewall, and it traces how violence against gay men and by gay men has been treated in the press. The study is by decades. He goes through the newspaper accounts, all of the crimes that he has found. Some of them haven't been talked about at all since those original newspaper clippings. And then he places it all in context. It's an excellent nonfiction study of true crime involving homosexuals, which is how it was originally dealt with. It was nominated for the 2020 Edgar Award for Best Fact Crime. It was on American Masters. It's one of five essential culture reads. And then it was one of Crime Read's best true crime books of the year. So pick this up if you've got some, if you're not just interested in the story, but if you're interested in how society has looked at gay men and murder.
If you want a week without a novel and you really want to get into some nonfiction.
It is great. It is a terrific book. So that just gets the mention. And I think we're out of time.
Okay. I want to say one thing, though. I actually just recently, for whatever reason, I've gotten several messages from people that said they cannot believe that you and I didn't know each other before the show. That we sound like we have been friends for years.
They really need to listen to our first two shows if they think we're lying about not knowing each other.
Well, I just hope it doesn't get out that even though we're very friendly on the show, we really can't stand each other.
Well, there is that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get on with Meredith Dench. Thank you, Justine.
Thank you. Talk to you later, Brad.
Please join our new Facebook page where you'll get updates about the show and we'll just talk about whatever comes up. Search for Queer Writers of Crime on Facebook or simply click the link in the show notes. Hello there, Meredith.
Hi, Brad. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, I'm really glad you're on. We kind of sort of knew each other for a little while there. And then both of us read at Queer Noir at the Bar, which was online reading.
Yeah, a fantastic experience.
Yes, it was. And I kind of got to know you a little bit more. And then on social media, we started following each other. And now I feel like you're an old friend.
I know.
You're 1,500 miles away from me, but I feel like we're almost buds.
Yeah, it's really cool. I think that the writing world, it might be in a part of this pandemic that we've just lived through, but I feel like, you know, there's just so much friendship and support in the queer writing community. And that's been one of my favorite things of this past year, getting to know so many more crime writers and people who are writing queer crime. It's been fantastic. You've been a part of that, yeah.
Yeah, it really has. And are you familiar with Garrick Jones?
No.
Okay, he's written some beautiful novels. And he is in Australia. And he and I chat pretty frequently. And we got to know each other better through interviewing him.
Yeah.
And sometimes we even do video calls. And having never stepped foot in Australia, sometimes I feel like he is a closer friend than some people that I...
Yeah. Yeah, it's really cool.
Well, I want to tell you, I had Robin Geigel on not long ago.
Uh-huh.
And I told her I rarely read prologues in novels. And when I tell people this, they really freak out.
Yeah.
They can't believe that I would skip it. And I'm like, I just go straight to the meat of the matter.
Right.
But I read hers, and I was glad I did. Having read the prologue in Deadeye, your novel, the two of you have now convinced me not to skip prologues any longer.
I hear that a lot. It's really crazy. A lot of people say that they just can't believe that there's prologues. All three of my books, and actually the one that's going to be coming out in March, it also has a prologue. So there's a lot of people who tell me that I skip them because I think they're like the pre-information stuff that I really don't need and jump to chapter one. But they serve a real purpose, and so I'm glad that maybe I've convinced you to, maybe me and Robin have convinced you with that.
I will say yours is important, if nothing else, to set the tone, because it really did.
Yeah, thank you. And also setting plays such a big role in a lot of the books that I, like the Luce Hansen series. And so I think that the prologue sort of set you into the place a little bit, too.
Yes, yes. I am learning that now. Serial killers are an interesting social science study because people find them repulsive and fascinating at the same time. We can't get enough movies and books about Dahmer and some of the others. I mean, how many times can you watch them? Well, apparently a lot.
Yeah. and
you can count me in as one of those that's absolutely fascinated by serial killers.
Yeah, I'm definitely in it too. As a matter of fact, yesterday was Serial Killer Saturday on the ID channel, and I probably spent a good 4 hours watching stuff that I already had seen before. So I can't get enough of it either.
That doesn't surprise me in the least. None whatsoever. Yeah. So eventually we're going to start talking about serial killers, but first I have this to say. My guest, Meredith Dench, is the author of the Luce Hansen Thriller series. Her work has appeared in literary journals such as Hayden's Fairy Review, Women's Studies Quarterly, and Gertrude. Her nonfiction essay, South Carolina, 2012, was nominated for a 2019 Pushcart Prize by the Tahoma Literary Review. She served as a fiction editor at Camera Obscura, Journal of Literature and Photography. Meredith lives in Ohio, where she teaches creative writing, literature, and composition at the University of Dayton. we talked about serial killers before your introduction. Yeah. I think the listeners by now have figured out that there is a serial killer in your novel, Deadeye.
Yeah. Actually, my protagonist, her name is Louise Hansen, and she specializes in tracking serial killers. She works for the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, which is basically Ohio's version of the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so her whole job centers around tracking these serial killers and where they're at and what they're doing. And she's particularly good at her job. And so I'm pretty much steeped in serial killers a lot of the time with this.
And I do want to talk about your interest in serial killers, but I'm worried that if I get into that, we'll have a 3-hour show on just that. So before we get on to that subject, since you've talked about Luce, tell us about Luce.
Well, you know, she has this really special place in my heart because I've been writing her so long. The first book, Cross, came out in 2015, and there's been 3 books in the series so far. I hope that there will be more. But she is, as I said, she specializes in tracking serial killers. By the time we get to the 3rd book, Deadeye, she is the co-director of the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation. So she's moved really high up in her position. But she's one of those people who is really fantastic at her job and really good at what she does, but she is not very good at life. You know, she struggles really hard. And over the course of the 3 books, she's grown a lot and changed a lot, but she has a lot of issues with addictions. She has these very strong emotions that tend to pull her down sometimes. And I would even argue that she just struggles with friendships, all of that. Life is difficult for her. And I will say that some of that, you know, she had a rough go of things coming up, and there's a lot of ghosts that seem to haunt her that she can't really seem to get rid of. So just for a couple of things to kind of let you know about her, but her mom abandoned her and her dad when she was a toddler. She went off to chase a career in Hollywood. It never came to fruition, and she ended up actually dying of a drug overdose, but she never came back. And so Luce was pretty much abandoned, and it was just her and her dad when she was growing up. And then when she was 15, Luce found her first love, Marcy, murdered by a serial killer. And that killer was never found at the time. That killer is found later in the book Cross. But at the time when she was 15, the crime went unsolved. And it hit her especially hard, not just because it was her lover, but it was also because she found her. And then also they were supposed to have met at a specific time, and Luce was late. So she really has spent her whole life feeling guilty or feeling like that was her fault. If she would have been there, maybe she could have done something, you know, she would have saved Marcy, that kind of a thing. So there's that, that's kind of always haunting her. And at the time that the first book opens, Cross, her father has also passed away. So she's really somebody who's kind of alone in the world, and probably in some ways keeps herself alone. I don't think that there's people who are interested in trying to include her in things, but she does keep herself off to herself a lot. That's Luce.
And you'll have to forgive me. I can't remember her love interest name.
She meets Harper Bennett in the 2nd book, who is the medical examiner for the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation. So by the 3rd book, their relationship is pretty cemented. I mean, it's a pretty solid relationship. It has been really good for Luce. It's really softened her and grounded her.
Mm-hmm.
But she still really struggles with these addictions and things like that, that Bennett isn't exactly, has trouble understanding.
So. Not only that, what I saw from it, they clearly are in love with each other. There's no denying that. But there's that tension because they're very different. And Luce is still dealing with that, I guess, struggle to be close to somebody.
Yeah. And I'm curious. I want to keep writing her beyond these books beyond these 3, because I would love to get, you know, I don't know how long it's going to take to get to a place where she can let somebody in, but I'm interested in finding out what that. So that's Luce for you.
So at least in your head, there's more to come.
Yes. Yeah.
Since we've talked about Luce, I'm going to let you do your sales pitch here. Tell us about Deadeye.
All right. Well, Deadeye is the third book, as I said. And so each book has its own serial killer that she's sort of tracking. So they do stand alone. But the stuff about Luce's life sort of builds. But in this particular book, Luce and her partner, Bennett, are on vacation in South Carolina, much needed Thanksgiving vacation. And they get the call that there has been an escape from an Ohio prison with one of their most talked about really high profile serial killers who went by the nickname of Deadeye. He was a serial predator and he had escaped from the prison. So Luce has to come back and they have to track him and find him. But the timing is really interesting to her because he was known for killing people during this time of deer season. And Thanksgiving is pretty much when deer season in Ohio starts. So she's wondering, you know, is he coming back? Is he back for more type of a thing? So that's what it's about. And he's somebody who's just a random shooter, a serial sniper in the woods. He does go back to the same location as where he was killing before, which is in southeastern Ohio. And he uses the time of deer season in Ohio is about 5 days, sometimes it's six. And he uses those 5 days to just wreak havoc on this community where people are hunting deer. And he's hunting humans during that time.
Well, that's kind of sick.
Yes, it is.
Now, one thing I'm curious about, Luce has been promoted up to co-director, but she still has a lot of higher ups.
Yeah.
Given Deadeye and his past, why was she chosen to be the person to kind of lead tracking this guy?
Well, some of the backstory is, you know, he was already in prison at the time that this book started and he escaped, right? So there was a whole entire investigation that had to find him through that first round after his first killings. And she was a part of that. So she was somebody who worked really closely with that case and knew about him. And that's why she was called in. Plus also her level of expertise, kind of like in her job of tracking, really pulls her in. But the thing that really makes it difficult for her in this particular case is in the past, when she's been tracking serial killers, they're usually not in such wooded areas. You know, this is really rural territory where they find themselves in this book. And she's not used to that. She's used to cities, that kind of a thing like that. And this kind of pushes her to be able to use more of her senses and to be like out in these woods where figuring out where these gunshots are coming from. She's never been hunting, you know, like those kinds of things. I mean, there's a part where she's been hunting as a kid, but she's not a regular hunter or any of those things. So it pushes her in a lot of different ways.
And you talk about these settings being in Ohio. I got to tell you, you really took me there.
Good.
Ohio tends to not be a state people think of when they think of, let's go see a beautiful state.
Right. Right.
And I had to drive from Cincinnati down to where I lived in North Carolina at the time. And I decided to take the long route. So from Cincinnati, I drove along the Ohio River to West Virginia till I got to the interstate and headed south. And I got to say, seeing those old riverboat towns, which was kind of sad because obviously the riverboats aren't there, but it just was a really cool feel.
Yeah.
In the mountains, it's just an absolutely beautiful state.
Yeah.
How significant as a writer is the setting?
Well, for me, it's really important. I mean, I wanted her to work in the state of Ohio, but beyond that, I'm somebody who grew up in Ohio, so I know it really well. And I also think that Ohio is one of those states, like kind of what you're talking about. Most people don't think of it as a pretty state, but the difference in landscape between southern Ohio versus northern Ohio is really quite drastic and different, right? And then there's also this area that I write about in southeastern. It is very hilly and very rural farmland right at the edge of the Appalachian Mountains, you know? And it's a beautiful, beautiful area too. And so the setting was really important to me because I wanted to use some of those really open spaces to be able to. There's something about being in open space that can feel very freeing, But it can also be terrifying too. You can't necessarily get your grounding, and particularly if you're under fire. So a lot of it had to do with that too. Cities, I thought, made things a little bit easier for her. And so the setting really kind of pulled into this. There's also a very real reason why I picked this part of Ohio, is that in this quadrant of Ohio, there have been some active serial killers that have worked that area. And it's a very beautiful place, but it's also a really almost feral place too. I mean, like, things are overgrown, you know, things like that kind of catch my attention, that the beauty can be scary too, depending on how you're looking at it. And so that was one of the things that really caught my attention, why people would pick this area of Ohio. It's easy to hide bodies, I would think, because it's rural. But there has to be more to it. And that's really what caught my attention with Deadeye, was, you know, that kind of thing.
First, I want to tell people, if they've ever had to drive from like Chicago to the Northeast, don't judge Ohio on Toledo.
Yeah.
There's a lot of states south of there, and there's some beautiful areas.
Yeah.
But given your skill at really putting me there, is there any writers in particular that you learned that from or studied that?
One of my favorite writers of all time is Tana French. And I absolutely love the way she writes crime fiction. Her cases happen in Ireland. But there's ways that her, particularly in her very first book, In the Wood, the way that she uses the wilderness to be scary and to be something that sort of becomes its own character is just really brilliant. And so all of her books are really, I really enjoy the way that setting works so strongly in those. But she's one of my all-time favorite. I also really love J.M. Redmond's series, the Mickey Knight series that's working. And their setting plays such a role in those. And then like Cheryl Head's, the Charlie Macklin's playing in Detroit. There's a real feel for the city that kind of comes through with those. And so, I think that that's kind of where I got those ideas, or where I've been thinking about them a lot. Kristen LaBianca is another one who writes the Roxanne Weary series, and that's from Cleveland or from Columbus. And that also gets a real feel for the city, too. I just think that the city can become, or the town, or wherever the person is writing about, it can become a character in itself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You're talking about woods can be scary.
Yeah.
There's a reason why Little Red Riding Hood and Hansel and Gretel all take place in the woods.
Yep. I think they're terrifying, especially at night, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, they can be.
Yeah.
So from reading the novel, I've never worked on an investigation with a serial killer, but it felt what I would think an operation would feel like. So I'm guessing that you have done your research on serial killers and police procedures. But before I get to that, what is it that interests you in serial killers?
Well, you know, I love to be afraid. But I caveat that by saying I like to be like safely afraid, right? Like I want it to be like a situation where I can pull myself out of the fear. So like movies and reading books and things like that. But I think that that's part of it. But I, you know, when I was a kid, I really was more afraid of things like monsters and ghosts. And, you know, I read all the Stephen King books when I was younger, and all of the things that he built really scared me. And towards the end of my high school career, like, you know, when I was getting ready to go into college, Jeffrey Dahmer was arrested, and he was from Ohio. His first murder happened in Ohio. It was northern from where I was, but that was such, I mean, that just opened up this whole other wild beast of terror for me. Like it just, that this person could do these things to another person, you know, a human like me could do these to another person. And I just remember being fascinated and watching the news and the clips of them bringing those big vats out from his apartment and flashlights going everywhere, because of course they were doing it at night. And, you know, the talk about the bodies found and the skulls, all that stuff. I remember it so clearly, but it also, it just brought on this new level of horror for me, that like, this is horror. Like that's what I've really found that. And so I just wanted to know everything I could possibly know about him. He was my introduction to the serial killer world. Mm-hmm. And it sort of just opened this door for all these others that came before him for me to really investigate. I want to know why. I want to know how a human can do this to another person, you know? And a part of it too, I think, was a way to maybe try to keep myself safe from that type of person, that maybe if I studied this enough, I would understand, or I would be able to recognize this person moving around in my society, that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. But my next encounter with them was when I was in college. I did my undergraduate in Indiana at Ball State. And there was a lesser known serial killer who was working in Indianapolis during that time, who was killing gay men, named Herbert Baumeister. And he was going around, he was picking up men in gay bars throughout Indiana and Columbus, and then taking them back to this house. He had a beautiful house in the Indianapolis area. Nice job, family, kids, everything. He'd kill the men in his house and leave their bodies in his yard. But I distinctly remember this was not something that was talked about a lot. And I was in the LGBTQ group on our campus, and two men from Indianapolis came to warn our group about this person who was picking up gay men in bars and taking them and killing them. And they had sketches. They were just like a grassroots group from the Indianapolis area of gay men who were trying to get the word out because the media wasn't. And that just, God, I mean, that was just like, it was such a huge thing that just caught my attention. I was scared for my friends. You know, it was just, it was a really, so I think that I've thought about it because it's been kind of part of the background noise of my life almost, you know?
You tend to think of a crazy killer as somebody just running down the street with a knife. And then you read about folks like this, and it's cold and calculated.
Right, right.
Who was the guy? He was attractive and lured women into his van. I think he was down in the Southeast. Mark Harmon played him in a movie. I'm totally drawing him.
I'm thinking about Ted Bundy. You're not thinking about Ted Bundy, are
No,
you?
Not Bundy. You would know if I said his name, but I can't for the life of me figure it out. But he fascinates me in the sense that he, just like I said, he used what he had. He was attractive and he was charming.
Yep.
And he used that to lure women into, well, for lack of a better word, his lair. And killed quite a few women by doing that. And it's disgusting. And yet at the same time, like I said, it's fascinating.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It pulls me right in every time. I'm disgusted by myself that I'm pulled in, but it does pull me in every time. Yeah.
You know, there's a certain reason why people slow down when they see a traffic accident. You know, we hate to admit that people do that, but they do.
Yeah.
There were quite a few excerpts in your novel that made me tingle or cringe a little bit, but there's one that really stuck with me, and I'm going to read it here. Lou says, "I couldn't deny that Deadeye's chosen souvenir item as odd. His choice to take the victim's bloody shirt or jacket mystified many. However, I saw the clothing as a marker, something he could hang up on his wall the same way someone might hang their blown-apart cardboard sheet from target practice for all to see. Bragging rights."
Yeah.
The reason why that gave me chills is because I know you've researched this, and the collection of items and the mementos and the calling cards, it seems like a fictional stereotype that you see in TVs and movies. But having read that book and based on your research, I'm going to guess there's some truth to that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, serial killers are well aware now that people are looking for what the souvenirs are that they're taking. So they're taking things that are more random and more weird and things that we might not miss at a crime scene, right? But I was thinking particularly, now this was something I purely made up. It did not come from a real case in any way. But I was thinking in my head that something that would bring back the memory of the kill and the fact that, you know, it still had, you know, some of the blood of the victim on it would be something that they would really use to relive. I mean, because what they say about these things that the killers take from scenes is that they relive the crimes over and over with them. And so I thought that a shirt or something that, you know, still had maybe the smell of the person on it or, you know, something like that would really be something that would be something that would really he'd want. So that's sort of where that came from. But yeah, these tokens and things that they take, they're fascinating in itself. I mean, you could fall down that rabbit hole of the information and, you know, of like different things that people have taken from scenes. And it's really interesting. Yeah.
Well, you're talking about them smelling the victims. That gave me the willies.
I know. But I really thought about that when I was putting this together, that I just thought a shirt is pretty personal. I mean, if you think about it, like the fabrics against your skin, you know, it's going to have some of the smell of you. It's going to have some of your blood if you were shot in it. So I just think it could be something that was very personal that would excite also the killer with it. So I know it's pretty sick. It's sick for me to even be talking about.
You need therapy. I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty gross.
Based on your research of serial killers, what is the most interesting thing that you've learned? Or were surprised by?
The most interesting thing. I would say how looking at the different ways in which they get rid of their bodies is the most interesting thing to me. Because if you think about it, for a serial killer, that's their biggest problem, is they've got this human that they need to discard with. And so for me, what was really interesting is looking at different ways that people got rid of them. Jeffrey Dahmer had his own method of liquefying the bodies, basically, and then eating parts of them. But there's been lots of different ways. I mean, like sinking bodies, things like that. But I am fascinated by the ways of like people like who try to put the bodies just like in the natural landscape. So like the Green River Killer, leaving them along the river just to disintegrate, basically. There's a couple of different ones like that who I found that really fascinating, like not really trying to hide it when you would think that this would be something that they would work so hard to hide, but yet leaving them out in the open. I find that to be the most interesting. You would think they would feel so much shame and stuff that they would want to cover it up and hide it. And no. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what I sort of thought a lot about.
I think it answered the question because it was interesting.
Yeah.
I'm curious, have you studied Cunanan at all?
Yes, actually I have. He's another one who didn't, he just walked away from them, right? I mean, he left them where they fell.
Yeah, and I'm curious in your research, I don't know how much you've researched on him. You know, Ryan Murphy did the movie on him.
It's such a good movie.
Yeah, it was really good. And I got to say, Darren Criss, when it first started, all I could picture was Blaine and Glee. And I said, this is not going to work. But it was a very short time that he was creeping me out.
Yeah.
Oh, a testament to his skill. Because that whole, oh, this is Blaine from Glee thing did not last really long. But there's a controversial thing in that film, and I don't know how much you've researched this to know. There's the scene in Chicago, the famous architect, where he went into the guy's house and basically tortured him and then lived in the house.
Yeah.
And that did happen. But in the movie, it was implied that they had had, at least at some point, some kind of sexual thing going on.
Right.
And the police and the family say there's nothing to show that that was the case. Do you know anything about that?
From what I've read, it was like he was trying to take over this guy's life, just moving into his home and living, almost pretending like he's living his life. So I read in what the parents were saying or what the family was saying was that there was no evidence that there was a relationship. But there has to be something about this particular person that caught his interest.
Yeah.
And it could easily be that it was the same thing that caught his eye about Versace, right? I mean, he didn't have any kind of a relationship with Versace.
Yeah.
You know, he just knew him from the media. And so it could have been a similar type of a situation or, you know, somebody who caught his eye and he started, I don't know, like admiring the work he did or something like that.
Because it did bother me. You know, Murphy's known for stretching the truth a little bit. And despite that being an incredible, I think it was a little miniseries, wasn't it? Yeah, it was multi-episodes. Yep. It was beautifully done. It does bother me that it was a very important part of the story in his interpretation. And it does bother me a little bit that we don't really know if that's what happened.
Right.
That's why I was wondering if you knew more.
Yeah, no, I think I'm in agreement with the family there that there's nothing to prove mm-hmm. there was anything between them.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Now, on top of serial killers, you teach a class on prison literature.
I do.
First, I have to ask, I think I know, what, pray tell, is prison literature?
Well, originally, when I started teaching the class, I called it prison literature because I only wanted it to be work that was completed by people who have been in prison, like either during the time they were in prison or when they came out of prison. But over the course of the years, I've been teaching the class, I think that this year will be my 8th year doing it. And so I've had to kind of adjust that a little bit so that we have some things that are about, like, written about prisoners who, from, you know, authors who haven't necessarily been in prison. But all of the work in the class or all of the things that we look at the life of an inmate in the United States, the historical track of, you know, how prisons sort of have evolved throughout the United States. And looking at kind of, I try to really use a lot of material of people who are actual inmates that have been written, that are writing. But yeah, it's a really fun class to teach. I really, really love it. It's a sad class to teach. There's a lot of really heavy, heavy topics that come up in it. But I have really wonderful students who want to know about this and want to know more. They're as curious about all of this as I am. So it's a really fun class.
Well, I'll tell you, if I was in Dayton, I would take that class because it sounds really, really interesting.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's really fun. It is a lot of one of the things that we really hit on in that class is that, you know, the historical sense of how prisons have evolved in the United States is really important to understanding where we're at right now. And so many people don't necessarily understand that timeline. And so that's one of the things that I think really drives the course. But it's a really fun class. My day job.
Well, sticking with that, you told me your favorite prison to visit is the Ohio State Reformatory.
Yes.
Okay. First of all, how does one go about visiting a prison? And what do you do there?
That must have sounded really weird, didn't it?
Yes. But, like, I don't picture people going and hanging out at the prisons.
Yeah, it's not a working prison at the moment. So it is one that it used to be the Ohio State, you know, reformatory for the whole entire state of Ohio. And I think that in 1994, somewhere around there, they closed it because they built a more modern prison, really basically in the backyard. Like, you can look right out the window and see the new prison that's right there. The inmates actually helped build the new prison while they were living in the reformatory. So it fell kind of into disrepair because once they moved all the inmates out of that older facility, it just sort of crumbled. It's been bought now by a private group who is turning it into a museum. It's where the movie Shawshank Redemption was filmed.
Ah, okay.
And yeah, so they use it for movie sets and things like that. But because the time of inmates, like how many years they've held inmates there, I mean, they go all the way back to like the 1890s. And in some cases, even, I mean, I think there might even be some that were a little bit before that of cases that came through there. And it's just incredibly fascinating to me to look at the arrest records and to see what people were being brought in for early on. For so long, I wanted to set a novel at this place. And so I spent a lot of time looking at the different cells and looking at, there's the warden has his own house that's kind of attached to the jail so that mm-hmm. his whole family lived there with him. I found that really fascinating too. But there's the historical information that's available on inmates of what they were arrested for is just really fascinating to me.
Yeah, I generally don't recommend touristy places, but if anybody goes to San Francisco, I do recommend taking the tour of Alcatraz.
Yeah, it's a lot like that.
I was really surprised how tiny those cells are. I mean, they're tiny.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they put two people in those, or sometimes three. Yeah.
I think in TV movies, they probably make them bigger to get the cameras in there.
Yeah.
Because it really doesn't capture
yeah.
how tight that is.
Yep.
Now, on top of teaching literature, do you get involved in genre fiction in your teaching?
I do. You know, it's hard for me not to talk about genre fiction in my teaching because I write it and that's what I read. I love it. I love to read it. And that doesn't mean that I don't read other things too, but I tend to talk about it in terms of examples and things like that. But this coming year, I'm teaching my first ever genre fiction class. So I'm very excited about that. There's been kind of a, again, like we were talking about this push-pull relationship, you know, kind of like with serial killers. There's also been like this push-pull relationship with genre fiction and the academy as well, too. And I've felt that, unfortunately, you know, with my writing and things like that. But I think that the tide is really changing and it's becoming much more accepted and admired even in some circles. And it's been interesting to watch that change happen.
Are you familiar with Orson Scott Card?
I'm not. I'm sorry.
Okay. That's okay. He's a popular science fiction writer. So if you don't read science fiction, you may not know him.
No.
He's very well known. Unfortunately, in his writings, he has hints of racism and is very clearly a homophobe. So I don't like to promote this guy. But
yeah.
He and I lived in the same city in Greensboro, North Carolina at one time. And he wrote an article for the local paper. And in the article, he said, if your kids are reading comic books, if they're reading fantasy, if they're reading sci-fi, get off their backs. They're reading. Just be grateful that they're reading anything.
Yeah.
I presume that you would agree with that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely do. And part of that is, too, I mean, my reading, like, you know, it was just, like, as a kid, and I shouldn't say a kid, like, when I was a teenager, you know, I just took in everything possible by Stephen King, and I kind of grew up on that, those types of writings, too, and I was very, very lucky in grad school to get Stephen Graham Jones, who is a horror writer, but he's also an academic, to work with when I was at Texas Tech. And I was really scared about one of the projects that I put forth to him was a version of Cross. I mean, it wasn't Cross in its full format, but it was a version of it. And there was a little bit of pushback from some people in the department, and they had some trouble finding readers for it, outside readers, things like that. Partly because there were gay characters, but then partly too that because this was genre fiction. But he was so wonderful in telling me, well, they're missing out. You know, you got to write what you got to write and just keep going. He's been such a huge influence to me. It's something I keep thinking about a lot with it. I don't know if my career or my writing career would have gone the way that it did without him to cheer me on in that way.
Yeah, I'm not going to say this is entirely true, but I did read one time that literature novels are a thing that everybody loves, but nobody reads. And I do think there is some truth to that sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, we have reached the stage of I have a question to ask you.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Yes. It's awkward questions authors get.
Okay.
Are you ready for the wheel spin?
Sure.
All righty. Hold still, and I'm going to spin the wheel here, and we're going to see what question you get. Okay, are you ready for your question?
I am ready.
Have you written anything I might have heard of?
Oh, that's an awesome one. And my answer is always no, I don't think so. I sincerely doubt I've written anything you've heard of. Oh, that's a really good one.
That's just rude.
It is. It really is. Yep.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you something about teaching literature. And
sure.
Something I've always been curious about, because stories can be so subjective.
Yeah.
I had a problem with metaphors. Teachers would talk about a metaphor, and I'm like, how do you know that's what they meant? You know?
Yeah.
You know, the old adage, sometimes an orange is just an orange.
Yeah.
Based on that, I'm curious, how do you grade something that's so subjective? What are you looking for?
Well, it's a little bit different I also teach creative writing. And so mostly with creative writing, there's a skill set that we're looking for. And if the writer improves with those skills over the course of time, like the semester. And with literature, it's, you know, I kind of, we have these rubrics that we grade with now, which I don't know if that was something that was used when you were in school or not. It wasn't when I was. And I remember being really confused about what particularly the, you know, professor or the teacher was looking for. And I think that these rubrics have really helped to clear things up, because the rubrics are given, at least the way that I do it, the rubrics are given at the same exact time that the assignment is given. And so it's spelled out exactly what we're looking, what I'm looking for. And those are the things that we're going to work on for the next couple of weeks as we're reading these books and, you know, working on your paper. And I think that that helps a lot to alleviate some of that questioning of, I don't know what you're looking for, and so I don't know where to focus, right? It gives the student a place to focus. And it also helps me a lot too, to like focusing for me and then working on different things for different assignments. And trying to keep it as subjective as possible is really helpful. I feel like I'm really a very lucky person to have the job that I have, because I get to talk about writing all day long and ways of making writing clearer, stronger, and also getting to talk about books all day too. I mean, it's really fantastic. And then to be able to write them, you know, it's hard to do both. And I do really struggle with, during the school year, I have a really hard time writing. And usually I use that for editing and then use the summers for production of material that I can then edit during the school year. But I have definitely been blessed with a job that I love. So
that's awesome. Yeah. A lot of people strive for that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I have one more question before I let you go. I want you to get out your crystal ball.
Okay.
What is your view of the future of queer crime fiction? How do you see it?
Wow. I see it getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It's so awesome right now to be a queer crime writer, because I actually was thinking about this yesterday. It feels like there's this wave of voices, you know, that are coming through right now. And just this wave of them, it's almost like this cacophony that is coming. And it's so exciting to be a part of that. I think it's just going to get bigger and bigger. You know, I don't know. What do you think?
I agree with you. I hope we're both right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, my guest today has been Meredith Dench, and we have been talking about Deadeye, which is her third novel in the Luce Hansen Thrillers. And it goes without saying there will be links in the show notes. So head over there. And thank you very much, Meredith. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much, Brad.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.